from VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Begüm Ersoy, video journalist in VOA's Turkish service. Our topic on this edition of the program, the future of Syria. Our special guest, Andrew Tabler, a fellow in the Geduld Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a think tank here in Washington. It's been 8 years since the Arab Spring inspired the peaceful, democratic uprising in Syria, which tragically morphed into a civil conflict and proxy war. In 2011, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad violently cracked down on protesters, refusing to make any reasonable concessions to his iron-fisted rule. No longer able to brook Assad's cruelty and defiance toward his people, thousands of soldiers defected. They called themselves the Free Syria Army, or FSA. They protected and collaborated with the civilian opposition. The FSA valiantly fought Assad, his backers Iran and Russia, and various Shia militias, particularly Hezbollah, a client of Iran. They also fought extremist Sunni Islamist militants, flush with foreign money from sympathetic individuals and governments. However, in the crucial months in which support to the FSA could have helped the FSA coalesce, U.S. President Barack Obama revealed not only his strong bias against military intervention or serious proxy backing for the rebels, but also skepticism about the Syrian opposition itself. A number of factors helped shape the trajectory of the conflict. The U.S. move to reject decisive military intervention against the Assad regime in the early days of the rebellion, along with its unwillingness to attack the regime after the Syrian military used sarin gas on hundreds of civilians in 2013 come to mind. Instead, the Obama administration opted for a Russian deal to dismantle Syria's chemical weapons arsenal, which ultimately did not stop the Syrian military from using chemical weapons. These decisions, along with Obama's relentless pursuit of a nuclear deal with Iran, all contributed to shaping the current political landscape. Today, notwithstanding the territorial defeat of ISIS, it remains a potent insurgency. Thanks to crucial support from Russia, which intervened in 2015 with forces and anti-aircraft systems, as well as from Iran, the regime of Bashar al-Assad now controls approximately 60% of the country's territory. Well, we'll talk with Andrew Tabler, one of the foremost experts on Syria, about the future of Syria as we take stock of how the conflict evolved. It has killed, wounded, or displaced millions of Syrians and generated the worst refugee crisis since World War II. In his post at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Andrew focuses on Syria and U.S. policy in the Levant. He achieved unparalleled long-term access to Bashar al-Assad's Syria. He's also the author of the book In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. And Andrew Tabler joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
And I'm delighted to welcome Begüm Ersoy. She's a video journalist in VOA's Turkish service.
Thank you for having me.
So, Andrew Tabler, do you think that thanks to Russia and Iran that Bashar al-Assad has indeed prevailed in Syria? What is the state of play in the conflict today?
Most media accounts you will read say that Bashar al-Assad has won the Syrian civil war. It's more accurate to say that the coalition of Russia and Iran, together with what's left of the Syrian military, has retaken about two-thirds of Syrian territory, roughly. In the other parts of Syria, in the northeastern part, the United States is aligned with the PYD, which is an offshoot of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, an archenemy of Turkey, in the effort to defeat ISIS. And in two other parts of northwestern Syria, Turkey holds territory with its military and backing Free Syrian Army units. And then last but not least, we have part of Syria, which is under the control of the rebels and particularly one group, HTS, an al-Qaeda affiliate. So we have an outcome in Syria, which is an imposed military victory involving the militaries of Iran, Russia on the side of Bashar al-Assad, the United States and the PYD, Turkey. And this outcome, while it has brought about a decrease in hostilities and actual death tolls, this outcome via international intervention in Syria is unacceptable to two neighboring countries. One is Israel, which sees Iran's presence there as antithetical and wants to launch efforts to get rid of Iran militarily. And of course, the other part is it's objectionable to Turkey, which finds the presence of the PYD in northeastern Syria as essentially U.S. support for their archenemies.
Well, we will get to Israel and Turkey in a minute, but before I turn to my colleague, I'd like you to look back. I mentioned some factors which I personally thought contributed to the situation today, mistakes made under the Obama administration. I'd like you to also look back to see to what extent had different decisions been made, if we would be in a different place today. Discuss the concrete junctures along the trajectory where things may have gone differently, and to what extent then the U.S. administration, under Obama in particular, perhaps helped to spawn this terrible situation.
About a year ago, I wrote an article about this in The Atlantic called How Syria Came to This. And what is important to point out is that, remember, that this all started with a little graffiti in southwest Syria. Four children scrawled on a wall, "It's your turn, doctor." It was a reference to what had happened to the Mubarak regime in Egypt and the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia. And the four children who scrawled this on a wall were arrested by the Syrian security services and tortured, and they were taken away from their parents. This led their parents to demand their return. When that didn't happen, they began to protest. And with every protest came increased regime repression. With every use of live fire came more deaths. With every death came a funeral and another opportunity to protest. And that use of violence in response to these protests spread throughout the country and put Syria on fire. These kinds of situations are challenging for any country, including superpowers, so to speak, like the United States, which has interests all over the world. And we have to point out that President Barack Obama was elected in many ways to get us out of wars in the Middle East, and particularly was elected because of America's involvement in the Iraq War and how that did not go according to plan. So early on, it was clear that the protests were going to continue, and many people in the U.S. government believed that it was inevitable that the Assad regime would fall by the end of 2011, and there was a debate inside of the administration. The difference, of course, between the Assad regime in Syria and the Mubarak regime in Egypt, for example, is that the Mubarak regime is a majoritarian regime. It comes from the majority sect in the country, Sunni Muslims. In Syria, it's a clientelistic, minority-dominated regime. It's a particular kind of regime, like Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. And they are gathered around, in the case of Syria, Alawites at their core, but they have other minorities, Christians, Druze, others around them. And this minority serves as the core of the regime, and it is galvanized against the kind of splits that you saw in the military in Egypt when they, instead of turning their guns on the Egyptian people, they instead removed Mubarak from power. In Syria, there wasn't anything like this because the officer corps, they felt common cause with Bashar al-Assad. What happened is that Bashar al-Assad did not fall on his own accord. President Obama positioned the United States to be on the right side of history, as he said. He had Hillary Clinton, who was then Secretary of State, read from the front steps of the State Department that President Assad must, quote, step aside. And so we had to decide, in terms of in policy circles, what was the best course of action. And a series of UN processes failed to bring about a settlement. And so by the summer of 2012, Syria is in an outright state of rebellion. The regime is rapidly losing territory. And in each part of Syrian territory, whether it's in the regime areas, in the opposition areas, or in the Kurdish areas, U.S. designated terrorist organizations are not only present, but they're becoming ascendant. So Syria's in full meltdown. The Security Cabinet put before President Obama a plan to arm and organize the Syrian opposition. It was a unanimous decision to back the plan. I believe it was presented by David Petraeus, the head of the CIA, as well as others. And President Obama vetoed that plan.
Yes, Hillary Clinton also backed that, and Panetta.
That's correct. He vetoed that plan. In vetoing that plan, and this is quite well known in Syria circles, he went against his entire security cabinet. But there was a very important ancillary decision which would prove to be disastrous for the United States. And that is, instead of organizing and arming the opposition, or at least organizing them or trying to organize them, it allowed U.S. Gulf allies to do so in our stead. Now, the reason why this is problematic is that the U.S. Gulf allies, along with allies in the region, look at the Syrian opposition differently than we do. And they saw particularly the role of Salafists, what became Salafist jihadists, as an effective fighting force against Bashar al-Assad. But these were forces that we were unwilling, of course, to back. And this then strengthened Salafist and Salafist jihadist units inside the Syrian rebels and led to the growth of al-Qaeda and ISIS. And this ended up being a disastrous decision. That was a very important juncture, to say the least. But there were a lot of others. The Red Line incident of 2013. Barack Obama, in the summer of 2012, in announcing he didn't want to back the Syrian rebels, makes a strange move to go out and publicly say that the use of chemical weapons would change his calculus in Syria and would be a red line. Now, this raised a lot of eyebrows, because if you don't want to become militarily involved, you probably don't want to lay down a red line on their use. And the reason why he was doing that is the Syrian regime, which had then one of the largest stockpiles of sarin in the world, was moving around and mixing these materials. Bashar al-Assad then began using them in lower concentrations on his own people throughout the fall of 2012. And then by the spring of 2013, chemical weapons use in Syria is prevalent. There's actually evidence of it. And the Obama administration publicly announces, I believe by, if it wasn't March, it was June of 2013, that the red line had been crossed. But it was very clear that President Obama did not feel that he wanted to become involved in Syria because he did nothing to prepare the American public nor anyone else that this red line was going to be enforced. And so what happened is that Bashar al-Assad and his regime, which read our signals very well and listen to all broadcasts like this one, they looked at this and they said, well, Obama's not going to intervene and enforce the red line. So they began increasing the concentrations, the use of sarin. And finally, this happened in the Ghouta attack in August of 2013. And that led to mass casualties, and that the images of those mass casualties suddenly caused the United States to bring warships off the coast of Syria, and the U.S. was dragged into trying to enforce this red line. As you mentioned, the U.S. did not end up doing that. Instead, they opted for a plan to rid Syria of its chemical weapons stockpile, supposedly. And it did. The lion's share of Syrian chemical weapons, particularly sarin, is now outside the country. However, the regime kept a certain part of their capabilities, and then after Syria was rid of these weapons, began using them again. And actually, chemical weapons use in Syria went up, and then instead not only involved sarin, but involved chlorine. And this was another major turning point in the Syrian war. And also, I think, sent a really damaging message to U.S. allies around the world. And that is, whether you're in Japan or South Korea and so on, would America come to your rescue when push came to shove? This was very controversial. So I think that was another major event. The other major turning point was then the outbreak of ISIS, because after this, the political process collapses. The opposition is decimated and is alienated from the United States. So ISIS then takes over huge amounts of Syrian territory and uses it as a staging ground to take over parts of Iraq. And then I believe at a certain point had as much territory as the size of Great Britain or maybe England. I think it's England or something roughly thereof. In response to that, the U.S. has to become more directly involved in Syria. But it has none of the political backing that you would have from a normal intervention in which the politics is lined up first and the military aspects are lined up second. So in order to fight the Islamic State, the Obama administration allied with the PYD, an offshoot of the PKK, and the archenemy of Turkey to go and defeat the Islamic State, which was very effective, by the way. You can say what you want about the PYD and its structure and so on, but they were very effective with U.S. air power at fighting the Islamic State, and we have to take our hats off to them. However, it did not obscure the fact that as they were defeating ISIS, that the longstanding animosity with Turkey remained. And so as the war has drawn down against ISIS, it has now caused increased tensions with Turkey, leading Turkey to threaten to invade Syrian territory and potentially set off a different kind of conflict. So maybe moving from the Syrian civil war into the Syrian war. And this is what faces us at the moment in the areas in which the United States is operating. In the areas that the U.S. is not operating, we have the largest pocket of al-Qaeda in the world in Idlib province. And then, we have huge swaths of Syrian territory, which are heavily influenced, if not dominated, by Iranian Revolutionary Guard-backed units and other kinds of Shia militia, many of which are also U.S.-designated terrorist organizations. And that outcome, in that part, is unacceptable to Israel, which is bombing almost weekly basis inside of Syrian territory with the permission of Russia, who the Israelis have close relations with and have been given sort of a license to bomb inside of that territory in a hope of degrading Iran's presence in the country. So while the Syrian civil war is winding down, so to speak, the Syrian war now threatens to expand and to break out. And that is very similar to the Lebanese civil war, which was a civil war for a relatively short amount of time, then became regionalized, internationalized.
Andrew, thank you for reviewing the various factors that have led us to where we are today, including decisions or lack of actions by the U.S. administration. We'll get into Trump administration in a moment. And the fact that, in particular, the Obama administration, once ISIS started to grow, they concentrated on ISIS and pretty much ignored the depredations of the Assad regime, which prompted the uprising to begin with. So we really haven't solved much. Mm-hmm. We have a short break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Andrew Tabler. He's a fellow in the Program on Arab Politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Begum Ersos. She's a video journalist in VOA's Turkish service. And here's a big shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Saeed Abdulbasit Ansari from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com. For more questions, let me now turn to my colleague, Begum Ersoz.
So two questions regarding the United States partnering with PYD, YPG in Syria. Turkey from the very beginning was telling U.S., okay, let's do this operation together against ISIS, whereas the United States decided to go and partner with the PYD in Syria. What was the reason behind the Obama administration's picking YPG to partner in Syria? And the second question would be on Turkey and the United States are currently working on the creation of a safe zone inside Syria. But Turkey wants to have a military presence there, whereas YPG does not want to see any Turkish troops in that safe zone. And reportedly, Washington is trying to talk the Syrian Kurds into that. So do you think that the two sides will find common ground in terms of the creation of the safe zone?
The reason why the U.S. partnered with the PYD, it's kind of an alphabet soup, but this offshoot of the PKK, I think was multifaceted. First of all, Turkey, like other regional allies, required that the United States commit to the overthrow of the Assad regime as part of that effort to support Free Syrian Army units and to bring about that kind of change. President Obama did not believe that the Free Syrian Army had the capabilities to overthrow the Assad regime. And they were also horribly divided, to be fair. They did not do themselves any favors. A Mandela figure, so to speak, did not emerge from that conflict. Instead, we had multiple warlords. So that was a major problem. There was another problem in that Turkey, during the period in particular, when the U.S. allowed Gulf allies to supply units inside of Syria, Turkey used an open borders policy. It was an unofficial one. It allowed men and materiel to flow to all of these groups in Syria because, of course, they were trying to overthrow the Assad regime. The problem is that intermixed with members of the Free Syrian Army were Salafists and sometimes Salafist jihadists, and they were transiting through Turkey, and there was increased U.S. intelligence of that. So there was a mistrust of and a confusion over Turkey's position. Turkey, however, I think was looking at the situation that, well, we're trying to overthrow the Assad regime first, because as you pointed out, the conflict started with President Assad, and also President Assad's forces are responsible for the lion's share of deaths inside of the country. So Turkey was behaving differently than our other ally, Jordan, which had sealed their border and had really dripped out support to the opposition in an effort to keep Salafists and Salafist jihadists at arm's length. So in the midst of this, the United States has to intervene eventually in 2014 inside of Syria. They don't want to commit to the overthrow of Assad. They observe Turkish behavior and don't want to give it too much carte blanche in terms of fighting in Syria. So instead, they turn to the YPG, PYD Kurds. The U.S. intervenes, but in a very narrow way, with a group that has proven very capable of fighting, is a Marxist group amongst Kurds, which is also not very popular in many parts of Iraq and elsewhere. And also had this relationship with the PKK, which the Turks regarded as hostile, which is very understandable. So that, I think, led the U.S. in that direction. And the U.S. started out the coalition to defeat ISIS. And over time, as you're right, Turkey said we should fight this together. There was, and I think the military was involved in this. I was not involved in it myself. But there were investigations into the Free Syrian Army and Turkmen forces, which Turkey was backing inside of Syria or were training inside of Turkish territory to move in. But apparently the observations by the U.S. military of those forces that they were not capable or ready to fight against the Islamic State. Now, some of these forces ended up going into the two Turkish areas. What we find in the Syria conflict is that if you have a local group and you have international or foreign air power or artillery and so on, and air support, you can take territory inside of Syria and hold it. And Turkey has done that with Free Syrian Army units and also Turkmen units in two different areas inside of Syria. That is how we got into the current situation. The issue of the safe zone is essentially a way to split the baby down the middle in northeast Syria, because Turkey wants the YPG, PYD Kurds to be contained. And the U.S. is pointing out that Turkey does not want to commit the kind of forces to actually take over all of the areas of eastern Syria that ISIS once controlled and is now controlled by the YPG, PYD. So the idea is to create this buffer zone. And the idea from the U.S. standpoint, I think, is to create a non-militarized one. But as you said, it's under negotiations. and that this would somehow keep Turkey and the PYD from fighting each other, and that they would see that there was an interest in not doing so, and this would then strengthen their position vis-a-vis the Assad regime and the Iranians and the Russians, who are very eager to take over these areas because they're very resource rich. And so the effort by the United States now is to try to get Turkey and the PYD, YPG, to see the forest through the trees, that it's better not to attack each other, but instead to hold firm, to not fight, and to block Assad regime, the Iranians and the Russians, from taking eastern Syria.
Well, we don't have many more minutes left, Andrew, but we want to take advantage of your deep knowledge. I guess the question is, where do we go from here, and how do you see the U.S. strategy in Syria under President Trump? Because he is always saying that we have to isolate Iran, we must punish Iran, we have to defend ally Israel, and yet it seems that his policy towards Syria, that of withdrawing troops, perhaps not the 2,000 which he announced at the end of 2018, but still withdraw troops, that's almost contradictory to the ultimate goal of trying to isolate Iran, because that only emboldens Iran, one could say, in Syria, and really it harms Israel and our larger interests.
I think the big differences of the Trump administration and of the Obama administration, first of all, it comes in the enforcement of the chemical weapons red line. It's been enforced by U.S. missile strikes on two occasions, in April of 2017 and then again in April of 2018, about a year ago. And those strikes have led to the decreased use of chemical weapons in Syria. And then since 2018, we don't have any verified cases. So in that sense, that's a major difference. And it showed, much as Vladimir Putin, I think, showed in terms of you can get involved in a conflict in Syria and not get sucked into a larger war. And I think that's a major difference. The other area, though, is that there is now a maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is designed to choke off its economic lifelines, particularly through the sale of oil. And that effort is part of the program to rip up the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement. But most importantly, and I think this is often overlooked, it's designed to roll back the advance of IRGC-backed groups throughout the Middle East. So this was a major difference. The Obama administration regarded Iran as a sort of natural balancing player in the Middle East, and that this balancing and allowing for Iranian interests in places like Syria would allow the United States to pull offshore and not become involved in Syria. And the desire to not be involved more militarily in Syria is bipartisan, by the way. It's both Democrats and Republicans, including those around President Trump, don't want to have U.S. troops inside of Syrian territory. The problem, of course, is that these countries like Syria are broken countries, and the U.S. has to become directly involved in fighting against ISIS. And last autumn, very famously, apparently President Trump, while on a phone call, at least according to reports, with President Erdogan of Turkey, President Erdogan tried to put President Trump in a hard dilemma, in a conundrum. And he said, Mr. President, why are you still fighting ISIS when you've already defeated them? And he said, you know what? You're right. You go and fight them instead. Of course, Turkey does not have the capability to go down the Euphrates River basin and take over all that territory, nor does it want to. So the U.S. has backed up from that position. They're going to keep some troops inside of Syria. And it's part of a campaign through the use of sanctions and the denial of those areas to the regime and the Iranians to increase Iran's expenditures inside of Syria and to get it to bring the boys home. So while we're trying to do this with less resources, less men on the ground and women, and less money of our own, the desire is to get the Iranians to exit Syria. And this is the overall goal of the administration. And they believe that in doing so, it will weaken President Assad's hand and finally get him to make concessions, which, as you pointed out, he has been unwilling to do so since the beginning of the Syrian civil war.
A quick answer. Do you think this policy would be successful in persuading Bashar al-Assad? I mean, Iran is such a part of its existence.
We already see signs that Iran is drawing down in parts of Syria, but we do not see it exiting. So it's still too early to say. I think also it's very important to point out that the maximum pressure campaign financially on the Islamic Republic is having very deep results. What that will lead to in terms of a strengthening of the IRGC, both in Iran and in the region, or a weakening of its position and causing it to bring people home, it remains to be seen, because the IRGC has its own way of generating revenue. It operates independently sometimes of the Iranian government. But for now, the maximum pressure campaign is designed to roll back Iranian influence. And so far, so good. Whether that's going to lead to the reconstruction of Syria with a balanced political agreement to which refugees can return and people can feel safe, right now is a long shot.
What about the fate of Bashar al-Assad? What do you predict?
Bashar al-Assad, I think, is unlikely to leave his post. I do think we're going to have elections in Syria, at least by 2021. I've observed a couple of Syrian elections, referendums during my life, and they're the most corrupt, fixed elections you could ever imagine. So I don't think that those kind of polls are going to deliver anything else other than a Bashar al-Assad victory, at least in the areas he controls. In the opposition areas, there's a big push by the United States to have the opposition and those in exile vote. And that will likely show very strong support for opposition elements and those that oppose Bashar al-Assad. And we're likely to have a political outcome in which the country is split.
And before we close, what about ISIS? This war has spawned ISIS, and notwithstanding the defeat of the territory which they controlled, they're still a powerful ideology and they're an insurgency. How do you see the implications for ISIS as a result of what's happened in Syria?
ISIS now has moved from an outright proto-state and army into an insurgency. And I would imagine that's where it's going to remain. And that's what happens to these groups. We know this from the Iraq War. While they hold territory for periods of time, they go underground and then carry out insurgent attacks on various forces. I think it's reasonable to expect that ISIS will continue to carry out these kind of attacks, and it will not be completely defeated in the sense that we have become accustomed to the understanding of defeat. But President Trump has said on a couple of occasions that we have militarily defeated ISIS. Whether there are certain pockets of it here, there, and everywhere is a different matter. The real question is, do those pockets of insurgency end up being a durable safe haven in which terrorists can organize and then carry out attacks against the United States? And if that happens, then the United States will likely, I think, go back into those areas. And we will be involved in a much longer war against ISIS, al-Qaeda, and groups like it.
In the meantime, Iran and Russia will continue to support Bashar al-Assad. Do Iran and Russia see eye to eye in Syria? Do they work together?
They work together more often than they work against each other. However, the Russians are keener to resurrect the Syrian state and to prop up Bashar al-Assad and to make the Syrian state Syrian and not Iranian dominated. The Iranians are keen to keep Assad as he is, and to set up a parallel system. Their method of taking over countries in the region is to set up parallel units, militia and so on, as they did in Lebanon with Lebanese Hezbollah, and then over time have some of those units integrated then into the armed forces of the country. And that, of course, has happened in Iraq. And once you have that kind of trajectory, then Iran is able to project its power into the future in a security and a political sense.
Beg you.
I have a question on Idlib in Syria. It's the last rebel stronghold in the country, and Russia has been pressing Turkey to do more in Idlib, and Turkey is concerned of a possible new wave of refugees from the area. So the regime might launch a big operation in the area. So what should we expect in Idlib in the coming months?
I expect that you're going to have increased attempts by the Assad regime and the Russians in particular, but with Iranian support, to take certain road arteries and rail arteries throughout Idlib province. And Syria is suffering economically due in part to U.S. sanctions, and there's a lot of pressure on the regime to deliver. So I think we're likely to see attempts to carve out parts of Idlib, but the capabilities of the Assad regime to completely take over Idlib and to throw refugees and insurgents and al-Qaeda elements into Turkey, which is the big fear, I think is limited as of now. If they decided to focus on that area, though, they could burst that pocket, and that would then send them north into Turkey and presumably northward into Europe. And if you have that kind of situation, it's very difficult to tell a refugee who deserves help from an insurgent who does not. And so that is the real worry, I think, for Turkey, but also for the European countries and for the United States.
Final words on implications of all that we've talked about for the future of Syria, the mistakes that were made, and the unfortunate situation with the civilian and the rebel opposition, that they were so hammered, the very allies that we would need for a democratic and stable Syria.
The problem we have at the moment is all the different powers that have intervened in Syria want to have their way and to impose their order, but no one wants to pay for it and pay for the country's reconstruction and to put the pieces of the country back together again. The Russians and the Iranians want the West and the United States to pay for it. The West and the United States look at the situation and say, well, why would we pay you to rebuild a country to which people do not feel safe to return? The problem is that if we don't do it, and we have to find allies who can, and allies that will pay and commit forces, and the U.S. government is trying to do that at the moment, that is the way that you keep ISIS down and deny these areas to the Assad regime, the Russians and the Iranians. But the problem is that requires committing political capital and trying to convince allies to make commitments inside of Syria that they are unwilling to make because they feel the U.S. over the course of this conflict from the beginning has not wanted to do what was necessary to bring about a peaceful and sustainable end to the war. And I think until we overcome that and assuage those fears, we're going to have a hard time cobbling together that kind of alliance that will check the Iranians and the Russians.
Andrew Tabler is a fellow in the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy here in Washington. Andrew, thank you for your tremendous insights on developments in Syria.
My pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Jiang Wang. And joining me on the program was Begum Ersoz. She's a video journalist in VOA's Turkish service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.